Hello, everybody. I'm Dr. Tessa Roynan, and this is going to be the first in three lectures on American literature. The subject of the lecture today is The Modern American Novel, An Introduction. I'm recording this lecture in Oxford on May Day. It's the 1st of May today, 2020. That's usually a big day here in Oxford, so I hope wherever you are and whenever you're listening to this lecture, that you're having a good day. So I'll just explain how this lecture is going to work. You should have a handout, a PDF that goes with it, that you can open up on your screen. So open up that PDF now, if you haven't done so yet. And you'll see that at the top I've explained I'm delivering the lecture as if it were the first one in a series over the course of a university term on the subject of the modern American novel. And you'll need to keep the document open on your screen and refer to it, looking at the passages that I direct you to, particularly as you listen to the first half of the lecture. So I'm not going to talk in great detail about all of these six novels today, but you need to imagine that you are going to be studying and reading these six novels over a kind of 10-week period, for example, and that today's is the kind of background lecture where I set out some of the key ideas or the key historical and mythological backgrounds that are so important in American literature, and that each of these very different, all wonderful but very different novels engage with in one way or another. And I'm going to spend probably about 10 or 15 minutes introducing the historical backgrounds, and then about 25 minutes talking about what we can learn from those and how those ideas are reflected in the novels in different ways. So you may or may not have read or have heard of the six novels that are on this course, and they are The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which was published in 1925, As They Lay Dying by William Faulkner, published in 1930, On the Road by Jack Kerouac, published in 1957. Then something very different called Ceremony, published by Leslie Marmon Silko in 1977. Toni Morrison's novel Beloved, that was published in 1987. And a novel called American Pastoral by Philip Roth, published in 1997. So I would encourage you to read all of these books. They're all fabulous. And we're going to talk a little bit about each of them towards the end of the lecture. I will be referring to various works of criticism and history and context. Two of them are here, the Ruland and Bradbury From Puritanism to Postmodernism, History of American Literature, and a book called The Literatures of Colonial America, which compiles lots of kind of primary documents that are a kind of record of the beginnings of America as a nation, which is a very fascinating subject. So the four little excerpts we're going to look at, and if you're not big on history, don't panic, we're just going to do brief snapshots of them and then move on. First of all, a letter from Christopher Columbus, who, as you probably know, reputedly discovered America. Discovery there in big air quotes, I think. So his letter from the 15th century. And then a letter from a Virginia colonist called John Smith. John Smith was a member of the Virginia Company, and he was involved in the founding of the colony Jamestown in Virginia. And that was very much a kind of capitalist venture. If you've seen the film Pocahontas or know anything about that's a kind of not very politically correct version of John Smith's story. In passage C, we're going to look at William Bradford's account of the Pilgrim Fathers' voyage to Massachusetts. You'll, I'm sure, have heard of the ship, the Mayflower, and in fact, 2020 is a fantastic year to be thinking about the Mayflower, because it's the 400th anniversary of the sailing of that ship, the voyage of the Mayflower, from Plymouth in Devon to Massachusetts, to what was to become Plymouth Plantation. And we'll be looking at Bradford's account of the Pilgrim Fathers' voyage and settlement. And then the last document I've chosen some excerpts from is the Founding Fathers' Declaration of Independence. So moving ahead 150 years or so to 1776, at the start of the American Revolution, when the colonies wanted to throw off the English ruling powers and establish an independent nation, which they did. So just to set the scene of how thinking about those passages are going to relate to the lecture as a whole, we'll think a little bit about the nature of America, the USA, and Americanness, and what that might mean. And you'll hear kind of two different approaches in this lecture. So one is me reading from a pre-written text, and then I'll talk a little bit kind of freestyle about the passages. And then the second half of the lecture is very much me reading. When you get to university, you'll find your lecturers do a combination of those things, and you'll probably end up deciding which you prefer. So you may have been on holiday in the USA. You may have lived there at some point in your life. You may even be American yourself. Right now, you're probably following some of the gloomy news about the progress of the coronavirus in the USA. At the very least, you'll have encountered this vast and diverse nation through music, film, and television. The USA is a country replete with mythology, defined by iconography, ripe for stereotypic generalizations. And for those reasons, it tends to provoke strong emotions, both positive and negative. Whatever your opinion of US economic military power, the current presidency, or the ubiquity of its culture, you'll already have a strong sense of what Americanness involves, or of what being American might mean. Our focus in this lecture, and on the course that follows from it, will be on novels published between 1925 and 1997. And we'll notice the preoccupation of modern American writing with history or with narratives about the past. And because of that preoccupation, it's essential that we understand the evolution of the nation and the way writing was absolutely key in that history, in that formation of the USA. When we turn to the modern novels that I'm going to discuss today, I'm going to draw on several insights from a book called From Puritanism to Postmodernism, A History of American Literature by Richard Ruland and Malcolm Bradbury. And they make several important points. The first is that European settlers, from the 16th century onwards, arrived with preconceived mythological notions of a new world before they set eyes on any physical landscape. And that, as they say, the idea of America as an exceptional place is an invention of Europe. Their second important observation is that the so-called New World was in fact not new, or virgin, or unsettled. In 1600, there were around 1.5 million native people whose cultures were varied and sophisticated, and they were there in what we now think of as the United States. The third important point is that writing, or texts, or books themselves have a particular significance in the American context. Modern America is a country that first came into existence out of writing, out of European writing. The Puritan colonizers of the early 17th century brought with them a simultaneous faith in and doubt about the capacity of language to reveal the extraordinary experience. American writing to this day is often acutely self-aware, sometimes fraught with anxiety, but it's rarely humble in its aspiration. And this paradox is only the first of many in a literary tradition characterized by multiple ironies, tensions, and opposing impulses. The seeds of America's guiding principles, or the divining characteristics of its outlook, are to be found in its earliest writings. We'll look at excerpts from the four documents excerpted in your handout, from the letter of Christopher Columbus to the Declaration of Independence, which was penned primarily by Thomas Jefferson. You'll see that each of these speaks clearly to the political pressures that shaped it, while at the same time implicitly claiming a kind of historical objectivity. Together, these paragraphs attest to the simultaneous power and inadequacy of the written word and of language itself. They thereby embody a contradiction which, as we shall see, is a preeminent concern in the modern American novel. So we'll look first at this letter of Christopher Columbus, supposedly written in 1493, about his first voyage of 1492. And this was translated anonymously from Latin in 1892. It's at the top of page 2 of your PDF handout. So just giving a little bit of context, most scholars agree Columbus was born near Genoa in Italy, in 1451. And after many unsuccessful quests for financial backing of his mission to discover a western trade route to Asia, he finally won the support of the Spanish monarchs and set sail on the first of his four exploratory voyages in 1492. This excerpt is from his letter from 1493, addressed to the treasurer of the Spanish king. And here he describes some of the sightings of his first voyage. And the first location that he saw was modern-day Cuba, which he calls Juana, and also modern-day Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which he calls Hispania. So I'm just going to read a little bit of it. You can always go back and look at more of it. So he says, "From this place I saw another island to the east, distant from this Juana, 54 miles, which I called forthwith Hispania, and I sailed to it. This island is surrounded by many very safe and wide harbours, not excelled by any others that I've ever seen. Many great and salubrious rivers flow through it. There are also many high mountains there. All these islands are very beautiful and distinguished by various qualities. They're accessible and full of a great variety of trees stretching up to the stars. I saw them as green and flourishing as they usually are in Spain in the month of May. Some of them were blossoming, some were bearing fruit. Each one was thriving in its own way. The nightingale and various other birds without number were singing. And this exceeds belief unless one has seen them. This Hispania abounds in different kinds of spices, in gold, in metals. On this island, indeed, the inhabitants of both sexes go always naked, just as they came into the world, except some of the women who use a covering of a leaf or some foliage or a cotton cloth, which they make themselves for that purpose." So in that passage, you can see, first of all, how Columbus flatters the Spanish monarchy, comparing these beautiful new islands to Spain in May. And also look at the things he focuses on. So the beauty of the islands, the fruitfulness, he's promising great wealth, and he's dwelling on these naked people and not accidentally on the naked women. That's a very important point in how the Americas were represented. So we can read this document pretty skeptically and look at the way he's trying to kind of sell his version of America to his sponsors. Moving on to the second passage, just a reminder, this is by John Smith, who was a businessman, really, an investor in the colony, so in colonial Virginia. But here he's writing a description of New England, which at that point meant kind of all of that colonized East Coast American territory. I've put a nice picture there. Well, I don't know if it is nice, but it's a picture anyway, illustrating Pocahontas saving John Smith's life. So that's how they thought of these things in 1870. And again, think of the motives behind this document. What's he really saying? He's trying to persuade people to move out to the colonies and invest in them so that this business venture will be successful. So at the beginning here, on this passage, he says, "I'm not so simple to think that ever any other motive than wealth will ever erect there a commonwealth, or draw company from their ease and humours at home, to stay in New England to effect my purposes. My purpose is not to persuade children from their parents, etc." He says, "People will come, young Murray people that have small wealth to live on, here by their labour may live exceeding well, provided always first there be sufficient power to command them. The master may quickly go rich, and these may learn their trades themselves to do the like, to a general and incredible benefit for the king and country, master and servant. Oh, religion above all things should move us, especially the clergy, if we're religious, to show our faith by our works in converting these poor salvages to the knowledge of God." And what's pretty revealing here is, not dissimilarly to Columbus, He's focusing on wealth and riches and how you can make a good living. So very much a kind of capitalist, materialist advertisement almost for why you should invest in this venture, why you should come and join in the colonizing of America. You're going to get rich. And then at the last minute, you'll see he suddenly adds in that religion above all things should move us. It's as if he remembers what he ought to be saying, which is, oh yes, and this is going to be a great missionary venture to convert the, as he calls it, savages to the knowledge of God. But he pretty obviously doesn't mean much of a religious purpose there. Moving on then to the third passage. So William Bradford's memoir of Plymouth Plantation. So this is from one of the people who sailed over on the Mayflower. And it's page 4 on your handout, I think, at the top. And this is from a chapter which he describes as of their voyage and how they passed the sea and of their safe arrival at Cape Cod. Of all the early American documents that I've read, this is the one that really captures my imagination. So I expect you can find a copy of this on Gutenberg Books or something like that. But it's actually pretty incredible to think of Massachusetts now and think back only 400 years to this voyage across the Atlantic and this kind of first settlement, the encounters from which the whole mythology of Thanksgiving, for example, has derived. Anyway, I'll read just a little excerpt of this. He's talking about the landing at Cape Cod. After a long beating at sea, they fell with that land which is called Cape Cod. The which being made and certainly known to be it, they were not a little joyful. But after they'd sailed that course about half the day, they fell amongst dangerous shoals and roaring breakers. And they were so far entangled therewith, as they conceived themselves in great danger. I'm just going to skip on a little bit. But here I cannot say, Bradford continues, but here I cannot but say and make a pause and stand half amazed at this poor people's present condition. And so I think will the reader too, when he well considers the same, being thus past the vast ocean and a sea of troubles before in their preparation, they had now no friends to welcome them, nor inns to entertain or refresh their weather-beaten bodies, no houses or much less towns to repair to seek for succour. And then he quotes a little bit from the Bible and talks about the savage barbarians. And then he describes the land, because I think they arrived in November. So November in Massachusetts isn't a walk in the park by any means, very cold. So at the end of that passage he says, for the season it was winter, and they that knew the winter of that country know them to be sharp and violent, and subject to cruel and fierce storms, dangerous to travel to known places, much more to search an unknown coast. Besides, what could they see but a hideous and desolate wilderness, full of wild beasts and wild men? And what multitude there might be of them, they knew not. So you'll see in this account that religion, the sense of God's providence, and scripture really are quite genuinely shaping Bradford's narrative. You can see a lot of words and images that give his account a biblical or an epic tone. I love the way he appeals to us directly to the reader, which I think really draws us in. It's interesting as well that way he draws a not a politically correct, but a kind of interesting analogy between the native people and the wild landscape. And he kind of mythologizes these wild beasts and the wilderness, giving everything this great kind of heroic tone. So when you look at this passage and compare it to John Smith's account, it's probably not that hard to think why it was this venture that has been claimed as the kind of first American mission rather than the Jamestown, Virginia colony. There's something much more kind of heroic in this story than there is in the Jamestown one, much less mercenary. It's religious. It's a story of survival and heroism. But it's interesting to think about that. Moving on to our last passage, so skipping forward 150 years or so to the Declaration of Independence, a very famous document penned by these founding fathers, perhaps primarily Thomas Jefferson, and it still is kind of enshrined as one of America's founding documents, along with its constitution. And this is a very famous beginning passage. So on page 5 of your handout, this Declaration of Independence begins like this. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." And I've put a little image there of what that document looks like. And then he says a little bit more about what horrible Great Britain has done, and why the colonies have wanted to break away. So that's the end of the passages on the handout. You can just listen now, but keep the document open so you can refer back to it. And I'm going to kind of discuss the significance of those and link it to these modern American novels, which may feel like rather a big leap or a stretch, but hopefully you'll see how the kind of seeds of these typically American preoccupations, very different as they all are kind of rooted in these experiences and these accounts, these narratives of America's beginnings. So, in their introduction to their recent 1,000-page New Literary History of America, which was published in 2010, the editors Grile Marcus and Werner Solers write that America's historical story has always stood, from its very first steps, as a temptation to the imagination. I think that's a great phrase to hold on to, a temptation to the imagination. The four extracts you've just encountered, which ostensibly present themselves as historical rather than literary, perfectly exemplify the workings of the imagination, of aspiration, of self-consciousness in the story of America's creation. Though they span three centuries and reflect changing perspectives, the texts have in common a tone of intense sincerity, but they're not reflections of facts, of objective truths. Not one of them can conceal the political influences that shaped it, nor the political goals that it hopes to achieve. The Letter of Columbus, back on your second page, epitomizes what scholars call an unstable text. Claiming to be an eyewitness account, it's dated months after the actual encounter, and the version we read today has been translated from Spanish into Latin and then into English. Its value lies not in what we learn about the Caribbean of the late 15th century. We cannot trust that account. But in what it tells us about European fantasies about a new world. Here we see Columbus as the biblical Adam, naming islands and claiming them for the Spanish, as Adam named the animals and thereby asserted human superiority in the book of Genesis. Columbus's paradise is like the classical golden age, like Spain in May. It's a promised land replete with golden spices, and there are scantily clad women wherever you look. The quest for perfection, the beauty of nature, the chance to get rich, the potential for romantic conquest, all the seeds of America's defining ideology and of the literature that takes issue with that ideology have been sown. In John Smith's recruitment drive for the settlement of 17th century New England, the financial motivations of the colonial project are laid bare. So that's referring back to the second passage, which I think is page 3 of your handout. Smith appeals unashamedly to what Philip Roth, nearly 5 centuries later, describes as the American appetite for ownership. The colonists' half-hearted and dutiful recollection that religion above all things should move us stands in striking contrast to William Bradford's moving account of the dangers endured by the Plymouth settlers, and his unshakable faith in what he calls God's good providence. Yet even as we might indeed stand half amazed with Bradford at the mere thought of a ship landing off a wintry Cape Cod in 1620, We cannot fail to notice his determination to monumentalize the significance of events. His account of what he calls the hideous and desolate wilderness, full of wild beasts and wild men, enlists the tenor of biblical epic that has endured in descriptions of American endeavors to this day. There is an obvious disparity between the Puritan vision of an unselfish community, in which, as Bradford says, we must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities, and the individualist ethos of Western capitalism that bears all the hallmarks of John Smith. So it's both telling and surprising that it's the pilgrims arriving on the Mayflower, embodying the noble ideal of the quest for religious freedom and displaying heroic powers of endurance, who were claimed by national mythology as the first Americans. Penned a century and a half later, the Declaration of Independence, the last passage that we looked at, takes American self-consciousness to a new level. Together with the Constitution of the United States, which was ratified in 1787 and then has been subject to numerous famous amendments, this document is the ultimate act of political self-fabrication. The UK, by contrast, has no written constitution, and there's been no historical moment at which either Britain or England has been required to sit down, contemplate, and write down its guiding principles or defining ideals. I could lecture for a whole week, don't worry, I won't, about all that is implied, intentionally and otherwise, by that one weighty sentence: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. It speaks volumes about the paradoxes and ironies of the Enlightenment world from which it emerges. This is supposedly a world of certainty, of human confidence, of belief in the power of the rational and of the written work. Truths at this time are apparently self-evident, and all men are created equal. Yes, but who is the creator of these men? And which men? And what about women? And if the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is inalienable, if it's self-evident, why does it need to be expressed in such dogmatic terms? Does writing this down protect it, work to guarantee it in some way? If so, what does this say about the power of the written word? And if not, then what? It's interesting to think that there's a popular pilgrimage site in Washington, D.C., that is the National Archives. You can look at their website, in which the original Declaration and the Constitution are enshrined like holy relics. When I went there, I was amused and struck to see that visitors are reassured that, among other security measures, the cases in which these documents are kept are, quote, nuclear safe. So if there was a nuclear explosion, they would survive. Arguably, this anecdotal observation tells you everything you need to know when embarking on a study of American literature. The USA and the world as we know it may be utterly destroyed by nuclear war, but somewhere in the smoking ruins, these texts and their flawed idealism will live on. The fact that when Jefferson and his colleagues declared all men to be created equal, they actually meant all white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men, has had repercussions that continue to this day. You'll see the fallout, if you like, from this demarcation in the six novels you'll be reading on this course. For certain white men, for James Gatz in The Great Gatsby, for Sal Paradise in On the Road, and for Swede Lvov in American Pastoral, achieving long-pursued happiness, which is somehow analogous to achieving Americanness, is not as easy as Jefferson makes it sound. And the Declaration's total failure to acknowledge the existence of native peoples, the assumptions that only men merit political attention, and the fateful erasure of a paragraph condemning slavery are among the many deafening silences that Silko in her novel Ceremony and Morrison in her novel Beloved have sought to address. The irony that a nation begun in violent conquest, owing its wealth and power to slavery, makes great fanfare of its commitment to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is so obvious that it hurts, but it's no less compelling for that. As Marcus and Solis write in their new literary history, America was made up of crime, sin, and, as the country found the words to name its mission, violation, a rebuke to its own professed ideals. With slavery, it was unmade as it was made. The American predicament, then, flawed aspiration, heroic failure, is a very human one. Ruland and Bradbury, glossing the famous intellectual George Santayana, observe that in the recurrent conflict between the ideal and the real, the utopian and the actual, the intentional and the accidental, the mythical and the diurnal, can be read an essential legacy of the Puritan imagination to the American mind. This also explains the enduring appeal of American history, of American experience, as a subject for literary exploration. A temptation to the imagination, indeed. A term that has great currency in the media and in the academic disciplines of economics, history, and political science, as well as within literary and cultural studies, is that of American exceptionalism. You could devote a 10-unit course to the evolution and different applications of that phrase in itself, American exceptionalism. Yet its core meaning is not complex. As it implies, it's the idea that America is somehow different, unique, or exceptional in relation to everywhere else, in its history, in its ideals, in its economic and political systems, and so on. As students and critics of American literature, it's important to be aware of the distinction between examining the phenomenon, between examining the phenomenon of exceptionalism on the one hand, that is to say, by looking at what the authors do with the idea, and endorsing or replicating it on the other, that is to say, by making exceptionist claims for the literature in itself. In case this strikes you as unwarranted pedantry, let's briefly survey the history of American literary criticism and look at some of the pits into which enthusiastically exceptionalist scholars have fallen. One of the many unresolved contradictions of American experience has been its conflicted or love-hate relationship with Europe. It is a new world, a nation of immigrants that has declared its independence from its ageing and outmoded parent. Yet the survival of European cultural legacies and the persistence of an idealized nostalgic yearning for the old world or the old country unsurprisingly endure to this day. Since American literature began to take itself seriously towards the end of the 18th century, since the neoclassical poetry of the slave woman Phyllis Wheatley, for example, or the so-called Gothic romances of Charles Brockden Brown, since the leather stocking novels of James Fenimore Cooper, or of Washington Irving's series stories such as Rip Van Winkle, both American authors and critics have tied themselves in knots over the issue of the originality or derivativeness of American writing. The 19th century philosopher and public intellectual Ralph Waldo Emerson, who lived from 1803 to 82, believed passionately in the possibility of a new, distinct American literary tradition. In his essay Nature, which he wrote in 1836, he laments a perceived continuing cultural deference to Europe, complaining that our age is retrospective, it builds the sepulchres of the fathers. Yet he himself repeatedly enlists Greek and Roman cultural references, for example in his 1844 essay The Poet, as part of the rhetoric by which he urges an innovative, independent literary tradition. This conundrum's no less real for recent and contemporary scholars of the American literary scene. Ruland and Bradbury are astute in their observation that all literary histories are critical fictions, and that American literary history is more fictional than most. Yet in the excerpt from the opening chapter that I've talked about at the beginning of this lecture, these critics write, "A fundamental difference exists between American literature and nearly all the other major literary traditions of the world. It's essentially a modern, recent, and international literature." Given that they go on to emphasise that America was first and foremost a construction of European writing, it's curious they fail to articulate here that the many legacies of European antiquity, for example the classical tradition and the European Judeo-Christian tradition, are consistent significant presences in American writing. Even the very name of the country, America, derives from the name of the Florentine merchant, explorer and writer, Amerigo Vespucci, who lived from 1454 to 1512. The idea that American literature is at once rootless and international ultimately makes no sense, so it can't be both rootless and international. It's also worth remembering that all literatures are in fact international. The English tradition, for example, is a product of Latin, Anglo-Saxon, Norse, Celtic, and Old French influences. No nation, and hence no literary tradition, is pure. The misrepresentation of literary history matters because it distorts political realities. It's surprising to find Marcus and Solos, writing in 2010, claiming that America's literature was not inherited but invented, as if it were a tool or a machine, and discovered as if it were a gold strike or the next wonder of the Louisiana Purchase. To overlook contemporary America's native, European, African, and Asian inheritances is to conceal its cultural and hence political infrastructure. While to subscribe to the admittedly attractive analogy between literal and literary discovery is to hark back to the euphoric rhetoric of people like D.H. Lawrence, who wrote his highly mythological studies in classic American literature in 1923, or William Carlos Williams, who did the same in his In the American Grain of 1925. The notion that American writers are themselves discoverers or conquerors ultimately bestows value on only certain kinds of perspective and experience. Among the authors on our course, for example, only Fitzgerald, Kerouac, and Roth would make the grade. Rouland and Bradbury usefully describe the beginnings of American studies, the appearance, quote, in the 1950s, in an age of rising American confidence as its role as a world power increased, of a series of scholarly works that sought for distinctive American themes, myths, languages, and psychic motifs, motivated by the conviction that there was a major tradition to be recovered and explored. These books exemplify exceptionalist accounts of American culture, exactly the approach that our course aims to avoid. As Campbell and Keane point out, the quest for a distinctive national character is problematic, first because it reduces questions of national identity to some essential singularity, only adding to the marginalisation of already marginalised groups, and second because it studies American society in isolation. While theoretical and critical approaches will not play a prominent part in our studies here, it's important to be aware that this course is rooted in what's known as the New American Studies, that is, in an outlook that's wary of the notion of any one archetypal American experience or paradigm, and that instead is concerned with diverse representations and a plurality of American experiences. It's also worth introducing the relatively recent term transnationalism. This is an unnecessarily grand word, transnationalism, for the useful truism that history and culture do not conform to national boundaries. Our course aims to position its 6 novels in a transnational context, for example, the set beloved on the stage of the transatlantic slave trade that involved Africa, Europe, the Caribbean and South America, as well as the USA. I'm just going to have a quick drink to get rid of that cough. Okay, to recognise the exceptionalist impulse both in American culture and perhaps even more so in the study of that culture, is to understand the lasting appeal of the notion of the great American novel. Both William Carlos Williams in 1923 and Philip Roth in 1973 ironically entitled one of their works The Great American Novel. This is a concept that now apparently merits its own Wikipedia entry, and it expresses an unofficial but enduring belief that the perfect American book, one that says all there is to say about America in the best possible form, has either been written, and there are many contenders for the so-called award, or can and will one day be written. As A.O. Scott wrote in his 2006 New York Times article, our mythical book, so the great American novel, is the one that will somehow include everything, at once reflecting and by some linguistic magic dissolving our intractable divisions and stubborn imperfections. You'll not be surprised to hear that in setting out to introduce you to six great American novels, this lecture does not endorse the concept of the great American novel. If it were to do so, Faulkner's, Silko's, and Morrison's contributions would be immediately disqualified, as on the face of it, they appear to engage very little with Americanness as it's conventionally understood. To choose only six novels from the immense and always expanding wealth that is the American literary tradition is inevitably to miss out on much that is great, to pass over the treasures of the 19th century, the stories of Poe, the slave narratives of Jacobs and Douglas, Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, published in 1850, Melville's Moby Dick of 1851, Twain's Huckleberry Finn of 1881, the poetry of Whitman and Dickinson, is a regrettable necessity. You should read these works, if you have time, at the end of our course or during it, because all of them make their presence felt in the modern texts that we'll study. To begin with The Great Gatsby in 1925 is to omit, among countless others, Henry James, Edith Wharton, both of whose masterpieces so perfectly express the transition from the Victorian to the modern age, Willa Cather, Ernest Hemingway, Vladimir Nabokov, Ralph Ellison, John Updike, Marilyn Robinson, Louise Erdrich. These are just a few of the significant absences from the course. So, what have our chosen novelists, Fitzgerald and Faulkner, Kerouac and Silko, Morrison and Roth, done right to earn themselves a much-contested place here on our course? They've been chosen not because they're the best, though each is, in its own way, brilliant, but because each gives voice to a different modern American experience, to the perspective of a specific locale and era. The Great Gatsby, set in Long Island and New York City in the 1920s, perfectly captures the moral vacuum at the heart of the post-World War I urban rich. Published only 5 years later, Faulkner's tragicomic novel, As I Lay Dying, could not be more different. Set in poverty-stricken rural Mississippi, it examines the collective and individual consciousness of members of the Bundren family and the fraught nature of communication between them. With Kerouac's On the Road, published in 1957, we encounter an iconic novel that for many people embodies or epitomizes American writing. As Sal Paradise and his friends traverse great swathes of the landscape, themselves reenacting the writing as conquest paradigm attributed to early settlers, the strategies by which they define Americanness and non-Americanness compel close scrutiny. Our fourth set text, Leslie Marmon Silko's Ceremony, published in 1977, necessitates yet another change of gear. Set primarily on New Mexico's Laguna Pueblo Reservation in the wake of World War II, it examines the attempt of Tayo, a young man of mixed Native and Euro-American descent, to confront his post-traumatic stress and to partake in traditional storytelling and religious ritual in order to get well. The book merits our attention for its brilliance in enlisting the experimental form of modernist prose fiction to the expression of an oral culture and tradition. And next, no less striking in its political engagement and its stylistic innovation, is Toni Morrison's Beloved. You'll be hearing much more about Toni Morrison in our third lecture in this series, which is all about her. But for now, all I'll say about Beloved is this. Centering on the experiences of Setha, an escaped slave woman living in Cincinnati, Ohio, after the Civil War, it explores the meanings of motherhood, of freedom, of violence and atonement in the context of slavery and its aftermath. As it is in As They Lay Dying and Ceremony, the nature of language itself, of communication, of how meaning is made, is one of the preeminent themes in this text. Indeed, through their concern with questions of literacy and the power or impotence of the word, these three books engage directly with the dilemmas implicit in that Manifesto for Enlightenment principles, the Declaration of Independence. Thus, though less overtly about the American dream than are the novels by Fitzgerald and Roth, These works are every bit as involved with questions of American identity and with the morality or immorality of American history. As literary articulations of a nation overtly committed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the writings of Fitzgerald, Faulkner, Kerouac, Silko, and Morrison might seem surprisingly invested in death, entrapment, and misery. Our final novel on this course, Philip Roth's American Pastoral, published in 1997, does not break with this trend. Set in rural and urban New Jersey during the turbulent 1960s and 70s, it explores the experiences of an outwardly successful Jewish man, Seymour Lavov, whose life becomes a travesty of all that America has promised. While this novel is in many ways the most conventionally told of the six, its deployment of Nathan Zuckerman as a profoundly speculative narrator means that it too, through its form, illuminates the ultimate instability and unreliability of language. Indeed, although the term modern in the title of this course is intended to denote a time period, rather than to suggest any specific criteria of the aesthetic movement of modernism, each of the texts on our course are stylistically both innovative and fascinating, and this is one of the many reasons they've been chosen. So I'm drawing the lecture to a close now, and I want to end it with some words of encouragement. At this introductory stage, it's important simply to urge you to relish, rather than be daunted by, the complexity and variety of narrative techniques you'll encounter in these books. As you read through these novels over the next few years, be sure to pay their formal qualities, the way they're written, the attention they deserve. Literature is literature because its authors have made conscious decisions about how they're going to write, about the words they're going to use, and about how they're going to arrange these words on a page. How the stories are told is inseparable from, is part of the meaning that they hold. This is true of every good book, but never more so than in these challenging, dazzling, and disturbing American texts. I hope you enjoy your reading.